the tape rolling. Good morning, all. I am Philip Corwin. I am a co-chair of the Working Group on Curative Rights Protections for IGOs and INGOs. To my right is Peter Rinford, the co-chair of the Working Group. It's clear from the standing room only crowd in the room that this is an issue of burning interest to the entire ICANN community. Is our agenda going to be projected on the screen here?
Yeah, I'm going to put it in probably on the screen, because when we put in Adobe Connect as we normally do, only those in Adobe Connect can see it. So just give me a few minutes.
Okay.
I had internet problems.
So we're standing by as we... What's that? Okay.
Yes. Please. Go ahead with the wrong call. That's actually a very good idea to go around the table. And please, if you are not working with anything else, please join us. There are seats over here. So I suggest that when we do the roll call, we also just shortly state our interest of being here. And as I said, I'm Pedro Rinfort, co-chair, and obviously I'm representing IPC here.
I'm Rudy Vensnik. I'm the chair of NPOC, the Not-for-Profit Operational Concerns Constituency in NCSG.
Barry Cobb, assisting ICANN staff.
And Mason Cole, I'm the genus of liaison to the GAC.
Steve Chan, ICANN staff.
Mary Wong, ICANN staff.
Lucas Mora from NextGM.
John Pizarro, legal advisor at the OECD.
And in the audience,
we asked to pay for the back seats.
Feel free to
at the table,
sit up
it's
here
free.
If you want. There's plenty of room.
Good morning, Brian Beckham from the World Intellectual Property Organization.
And we also have remote participants online,
yes,
including some members of the working group.
Okay.
We have George Kirikos, Paul Tattersfield, George Kirikos and Paul Tattersfield, who are not able to be with us physically in Buenos Aires and who are members of the working group. We also have more folks joining even as we speak.
Lori, did you want to state your name for the record? We're doing a roll call of those in the room.
Okay. Lori Schulman, International Trademark Association and IPC.
And as previously noted, I'm Phil Corwin, and my affiliation is with the business constituency. Do any members of the working group have updates to their statement of interest? Hearing none. We'll proceed. Item two on the agenda is the status report to the community on our preliminary recommendation regarding standing to file a curative rights complaint. And we're happy to take questions and answers on that after we give that. The preliminary, everything I'm saying is a preliminary conclusion. It's all preliminary until we issue our final report, and we anticipate... hope to do so prior to the Dublin meeting this year. Our preliminary conclusion after extensive review of the background materials regarding the relationship of IGOs to trademark protection is that standing to file for curative rights process protection, whether it's in the existing rights protections of the UDRP and URS, or in some new CRP that might be created, should be based upon filing for protection, filing with the World Intellectual Property Organization for protection under Article 6 tier of the Paris Convention. We concluded that because the Paris Convention is the agreed upon methodology, agreed upon by governments, for protecting various rights, including the rights of IGOs to seek protection of their names and acronyms of their names in national trademark systems. So, number one, it's the recognized route for doing so. Number two, it's a very low barrier to gaining protection. It simply requires submitting a notice to WIPO that the organization is seeking that protection, and then WIPO sends out a notice to all nations that have signed the Paris Convention, as well as all nations that are members of the World Trade Organization. Each of those nations then generally accords protection to the names and acronyms of IGOs in their national trademark system, so they're not compelled to. A nation may, for whatever reason, opt out of providing that protection to an individual IGO, although that, as far as we've been able to find, is a quite rare occurrence, if ever, that such protection would be refused, and that, in fact, provides protection to the organization without having to formally file a trademark application in any particular nation. So that's the method that governments have come up for to protect low barrier to entry. The consequence of that decision is that IGOs, which have nothing more than a domain website at .int, would not satisfy the standing requirement. But again, we don't think this isn't burdensome in any way on an IGO under the approach we're taking. So I'm looking to, I didn't bring my distance glasses. I'm looking at the, Peter, yes.
Well, Jim, just so everybody's on what it's stated there, what we discussed previously was rather than to create a new dispute resolution policy or to make changes in the UDRP, they thought it would be convenient actually to more make a presentation or a guide. For instance, WIPO has an overview of WIPO panel views on selected UDRP questions, and we suggested, for instance, that regarding the first UDRP element, the grounds for filing a case, that we could add a text that does the complainant have UDRP relevant trademark rights in a name or abbreviation of the complainant that has been communicated under Article 6 of the Paris Convention for the Protection of Industrial Property. And the suggested reply, or just a working suggestion, but in the case the complainant is an international intergovernmental organization, IGO, meaning an organization with an international legal personality established by international agreement, the complainant may have trademark rights in the form of names and acronyms protected under Article 6 of the Paris Convention for the Protection of Industrial Property that have been duly communicated to the countries of the Union through the intermediary of the International Bureau, stating that they could claim it, not even if it's not identical to a trademark, but it's it could be counted as the same as trademark rights, registered trademark rights, and thereby be possible to use the UDRP without any further changes in the legal text.
Thank you for providing that further information, Peter. So let me stop there and see if anyone in the room has any questions about our preliminary conclusions regarding standing and adding make clear that everyone understands this. We're talking now about intergovernmental organizations. Early on, the working group decided that international non-governmental organizations did not need any consideration in our process. They are not created by governments. There's no sovereign immunity issue for them. If they have filed trademarks for their names or any acronyms of their names, they have standing for any existing dispute resolution process created by ICANN. So we didn't. They're basically private sector entities and not in any way connected to the public sector, and there was no need for special consideration for them. So let me open it up now to any questions from anyone in the room or anyone online who has questions about the standing issue. Go ahead.
Thanks, Phil. Brian Beckham from WIPO for the record. I wanted to make just two minor observations, and one was with regard to, Phil, you mentioned that with respect to Sixter, of course, it was the way you phrased it was correct. It's sort of a repository for information about IGO names and acronyms. But just one clarification, which I think is maybe a little bit important to the work of this group, is that you mentioned that states could, for any reason or for some reason, I don't remember the exact language you used, choose not to give application to a recordation of an IGO name or acronym in the WIPO Sixter database. The rationale behind that is where the state would determine that such use or registration, and we're talking here in this context of a trademark, and I'll just read the language, is probably not of such a nature as to mislead the public as to the existence of a connection between the user and the organization. So I just wanted to sort of remind everyone that the rationale behind the protection granted via the Paris Convention was to prevent misleading use of an IGO name or acronym to the public. And then, Petter, you mentioned the WIPO overview, and of course, as an IGO, WIPO hasn't been participating in the working group, but we have been observing the working of this group. We've been looking at the transcripts and listening to the phone calls. When you mentioned the WIPO overview, of course, the WIPO overview is often referred to as the WIPO jurisprudential overview. And that, by its nature, presupposes that there are cases that come before this. So the current iteration of the WIPO overview, in effect, takes stock of the tens of thousands of UDRP cases that WIPO panelists have decided. So in other words, it looks backwards at the jurisprudence in the cases rather than looks forward to provide guidance to panelists. So just maybe a minor clarification for when you guys are thinking about making suggestions with respect to the WIPO overview and how panelists might look at IGO rights under the UDRP or another type of dispute resolution mechanism.
Petter, thanks. And I fully understand what you mean. What we think it this way instead. What we wanted to create was some kind of recommendation or clarification. And the overview may not be the right place, but to get out some formal information for IGOs that they could, as we think, use the UDRP, claiming the registered six-tier rights. And another addition, I know that from GAC, they have referred to their own created list, stating that not everybody GAC members accept the sixth tier. But what we understand, that list is there are several others IGOs on that list that obviously have not signed up formally for sixth tier. So we're not sure. We concluded fairly early that it was better to have the more formal legally reference to 6TER rather than to the list.
And just to add to that, there's a policy reason for that, which is that should generally enforce recognized legal rights. ICANN has no business creating new rights, and registering a domain name at .int does not create any legal rights. The legal rights for IGOs aside would exist either from a trademark registration or from exercising their rights under Article 6TER. So there has to be some existing basis in the world legal system for assertion of rights to provide standing, and that's the reason for the approach we've taken. Yes, sir.
Rudy, for the transcript, maybe a small question to clarify my mind. You say when they register a domain name, they don't get a right, but somehow it enforces the right when they own a brand or a trademark. It is enforcing that right by having that domain name on top of it, or is that wrong?
Well, purely a domain name is still just a technical address. But, of course, there are examples of companies that didn't have a formal trademark and registered their domain name and used it, and it became a trademark that way. So, yes, you're right in that many companies or organizations have actually made their trademark well known through the use of the internet. And suddenly the web address, so to speak, has become a trademark.
If I may, as a follow-up, Rudy, for the transcript, does that fit also for IGOs in that case? Because IGOs in principle don't have a brand or a trademark, but that's the question, and I think for WIPO also, that it is important to know what is the right they are getting by registering the domain name.
As a general matter, you gain no legal rights from registering a domain. As Peter mentioned, if you do business under that domain name for years and years, you may acquire some type of rights in it, but the mere act of registration does not confer any legal rights upon the registrant. And I see Lori wants to jump in on this.
Yeah, I was going to add, I mean, where I think some of the confusion may lie is in terms of the UDRP or contesting rights. You know, you have you buy a domain name, it's essentially a license. And then you can operate that domain name to point to any web, you know, any web content you choose. But under a dispute resolution mechanism where someone to challenge your registration of the domain name, that's when the underlying rights come in. So it's layers. So to support the registration of the name, to prove that you have a good faith versus maybe not a good faith intent, then you would look to the underlying content on the page. So as the source identifier for the web, where do you go? There, it's simply a license, like you know anything else. And when you go to the particularly the UDRP, it's about the bad faith. So that's when, let's say, I don't know, WIPO registers WIPO.int, and then someone comes in and registers WIPO.com. And you go, and that's when you would look to the content, because if you go to WIPO.com, and there's some suggestion there of an affiliation with the international organization, and they're not the international organization, and maybe there's an e-commerce site on it, and they want you to buy a certificate of authenticity for something. You know, then you're looking at profiting off a name. But that's very different than if there is a WIPO.com, and maybe it's the world information of poetry, and I mean some other name where WIPO might become the acronym. I'm sorry, I can't think of this. So it's contextual as well as just at the base level of the name. That's what I'm trying to get across. And the UDRP is really only looking at the bad faith part. So there isn't a vested right per se in the domain as much as it is whether or not you're registering it in good or bad faith.
Does that make sense? Yeah, I'll jump in on that. I think Petter wants to comment too. And let me add, we have not yet made a final conclusion on, while we've decided that standing should be based on the procedurally exercising your requesting protection under Article 6 tier, we haven't decided whether we would recommend any further elements to the decisional part. And let me explain that. Under the UDRP, the UDRP says that allows a complaint to be filed, whereas an assertion that the domain name that the complaint is filed against is identical or confusingly similar to the name or acronym of the complainant, that the registrant has no legitimate rights in the name they've registered as a domain, and that the registration, that both the registration and the use of the domain are in bad faith. Now, Article 6 tier provides protection which is similar but not identical to those elements. So we haven't yet decided whether we would recommend that the standing, that the what needs to be proved by the complaint would be identical, let's say, if we decide not to create a new curative rights process, whether what needs to be proved by the complaint would be identical to what needs to be proved to prevail in a UDRP, or whether we would recommend some slight difference in the elements that need to be proved based on the Article 6 tier language, if that is the basis for the standing. We're going to have to come back to that issue. But they're very close, and the intent is the same. And to give an example, that one I've been using, the acronym for the World Health Organization is WHO, which is an extremely common English word. And as background, of course, many entities can have a trademark in the same word. The trademark system is a national. The difficulty applying the trademark system to the internet is that in each case it's a national system which provides protection in a particular nation for a word or an abbreviation for a particular segment of goods and services. Therefore, you can have trademarks for United Airlines, United Van Lines, United Health Service. They all have a trademark that involves United, but it's all for different goods and services. So, for example, if there is a if there were to be a website, who.ninja, and it's a website devoted to a listing of famous ninjas in history, you would look at the use of the website and you'd conclude that there's no bad faith use because there's nothing related to health and medicine. But if instead it's a the webpage involves all kinds of things about the practice of medicine and health, you might conclude that the registration was in bad faith. So you need to look not just at the term, but at the actual use of the website in the curative rights process.
Yeah, I say Phil said it much better with the WHO versus me trying to figure out something for WIPO. But that's the bottom line. It's about context, and it's the context that's below the actual use of the name as an addressed identifier. And that's where I think a lot of confusion comes in, quite frankly. Because trademark attorneys, I think, are very used to context, subtextual analyses, and I think generally the rest of the community has a harder time with that, the way I see it.
And for WIPO, just let's say you had a website, WIPO.edu, and it was for the Westboro Intermediary Parents Organization. It was for a a parents group at some intermediate school somewhere. You would immediately look at the website and say, this has nothing to do with intellectual property rights, and there's no infringement going on here.
Yeah, and that is the same for trademarks. I mean, if you register apple.com and have pay-per-click to fruit salesmen, that's okay. But if there is, among these fruit salesmen, there are one pay-per-click link to something that relates to computers or something else connected to the other apples, so to speak. then there's a fraud. Please. Yeah.
This is Mary from staff. A couple of things. One, since we started, we've had a few more folks join the meeting. I think we have Jim Bykoff on the line, and in Adobe Connect, we have Alan Woods, Christine Doreen, who's a member of the working group, and Trevor Little. So that's one. And the other point is I wanted to particularly welcome our NextGen participant, because NextGen is one of the new ICANN initiatives for outreach in the region. The third is, actually, Phil, I think you made the point that we wanted to clarify from the staff perspective that on the substantive grounds on whether you can win a complaint, you first have standing to file, meaning you're allowed to file, and then you have to prove the substantive grounds, bad faith, et cetera, et cetera. And as Phil noted, the working group will have to come back to this point and align its recommendations to the extent it follows through with the six-tier standing issue. There is a comment from George Kirikos, and it is about acronyms and the six-tier database. He would like to point out that CPA is in the six-tier database, standing for the Permanent Court of Arbitration in English, and I won't mangle the French version. Apologies for that, but it's probably better I don't. And his point is that many organizations that are unrelated to this court can use that acronym. And the example he gives is the Composite Panel Association in the United States that has a registered trademark for engineered wood products. He also further points out that CPA.com is not owned by the Permanent Court of Arbitration.
In the United States, at least, CPA is a very common term that means certified public accountant. I forget whether .CPA is a new TLD that's been applied for. I don't recall, but you could certainly have, FredSmithCPA.com, and he's an accountant, and that's his website for his business. And there's no infringement on that IGO. Were there any more questions on the standing? And if not, Mary, you don't need to put it up, but is the next issue the sovereign immunity issue? So any more discussion that people want on the standing issue? Or if not, we can move on. Hearing none, seeing none. Yes, Mary.
Speaking for George Kirikos again, his comment, just to close off the last comment you made, is that there are multiple applications for .CPA.
Okay. I thought there might have been. And clearly, and I don't believe any objections have been filed by that IGO against the .CPA applications under the objection processes that ICANN permits for top-level objections. Mary, could you just read the next item in the agenda, and then we can proceed on it? We don't need to put it on the screen.
This is Mary from ICANN staff again. The next item would be a status report to the community on the working group's progress on the issue of IGO immunity, followed by question and answer.
Okay. Thank you. That's what I thought it was. Now this is the issue. The general disposition of the working group is not to create a new curative rights process for IGOs unless it was absolutely required because of the sovereign immunity issue. The sovereign immunity issue would arise in the rare case that an IGO brought a complaint against the domain registrant, won the complaint, and this would only be under the UDRP because the URS does not provide for a right of appeal to national court for either party. So let's IGO, WIPO, someone's misusing the WIPO name. They believe it's some domain. They file a UDRP. They win the UDRP, and the registrant files an appeal in a national court that's permitted under the UDRP rules, which would be a court of appropriate jurisdiction based upon the location of the registrant or the registrar. And so the issue involves it's recognized that the concept of sovereign immunity has been out there for a long time. Nations have it, IGOs have it, because they're organizations composed of governments and established by treaties between governments. And the question is, would that, in that rare circumstance where a losing registrant filed a judicial appeal in some national court, would that violate the scope of the sovereign immunity for an IGO? The working group to date has not reached any final conclusion on this. We have determined that in the modern world, the scope of sovereign immunity is not absolute. There are limitations on it. And it generally boils down to whether exposing the IGO to judicial jurisdiction would interfere with its core functions and not some peripheral functions. So in that context, the question would be whether the use of a domain name relates to the core functions of the IGO. Now, we've done some research as a working group on this. We got input from one person with some legal expertise on this, but we don't feel that the feel fully satisfied that we fully understand the prevailing consensus view on the scope of sovereign immunity for IGOs in this decade of the 21st century, and we are endeavoring with the assistance of staff to obtain some modest funding from ICANN for the retention of a legal expert with expertise in this field to advise us on that, and we expect to have that approved and to have a list of potential candidates very shortly. So, just so expectations are realistic, we would have to be, I think we'd have to hear from whoever's retained that exposing an IGO to that very rare circumstance of judicial appeal by the registrant would so violate their recognized sovereign immunity that we'd need to endeavor to create an entirely new curative rights process, which does not provide an appeal mechanism through the courts, but would provide some other type of appeal that would be different from the UDRP in that regard. So let me stop there and see if Petter has anything to add on this subject, and then we can open it up for discussion and questions.
Well, I just wanted to add that the issue is not perfectly new. And already in 2002, the WIPO General Assembly adopted a recommendation on amending the UDRP to protect IGO names and abbreviations, and there has also been suggestions on a special appeal system for IGOs that was created in 2003 but not adopted. So what I may want to just add is that we also had an informal meeting Monday morning with some of the GAC members, and Thomas Schneider was there, and we didn't went into any specific details on the topics, but we agreed upon that we had this limited timeline, and we will this way started to have a online communication directly with GAC that we hopefully from both parties can get our questions and replies and work more informal way. What I especially noticed was Thomas noted that there's a need for a practical solution rather than a legal, which I take is maybe more a way to see if we can come out with some recommendations still rather than creating a new specific new dispute resolution system. So even if this was very informal initial meeting, I think it was quite positive that they now have noticed our timelines and will work actively with us.
And if I could just add on to that, throughout our process, we've invited the both input and participation by GAC members and by IGOs. We've been completely open. We've gotten some responses from them. The other thing I wanted to mention here is that to put the appeals issue in context, just as ICANN has no authority to create legal rights, ICANN has no authority to extinguish legal rights. There are two parties to a dispute resolution process, and the registrant has legal rights. And the registrant, while there's no uniform opinion on whether or not a domain is a form of property or of intellectual property, it's generally a domain is generally recognized to constitute some valuable collection of intangible, be an intangible asset with some value, and it can't simply be taken away. So we can't have a curative rights process that extinguishes the right of the registrant to have access and exercise whatever legal rights they have in their nation of residence or wherever else they have legal contacts with. So that's the other side of this issue. So, but we're looking forward to consulting with a recognized legal expert, and then once we determine what the consensus view is on the scope of sovereign immunity for IGOs, we can proceed, I think, quite rapidly toward completing our work and preparing an initial final report and recommendations for public comment, which we certainly hope to do prior to the Dublin meeting. I don't think we'll be completely done by Dublin, but we certainly hope to have an initial report out there for comment that can be discussed in Dublin. And with that, I'll open it for comments, questions, or anything else that folks might want to do in this room or from the online environment. Yes, Mary.
Thank you, Mary Wong from staff again. There is a comment from George in the Adobe room, although I think it might have been to part of the prior conversation, but I'll read it for the record. George says that we know that IGOs have filed lawsuits as well as UDRP complaints, including the World Bank, amongst others. And I think this is a point that has been discussed by the working group in prior meetings. What you see on the screen, and we don't have to discuss this, Phil, I intended for this to maybe accompany your presentation. It is a document that is part of an effort that we have with the GAC, where every month the policy staff sends basically a one-page briefing paper on ongoing projects to the GAC. And obviously, as this is an ongoing PDP, this is one of the projects that we report on. We publish the same update, so it's not that the GAC gets different information, but that this is sent specifically to the GAC, and we publish the same information to our community as well. The last point I wanted to make, Phil, following up on what you've just said, is that as a reminder, and actually most folks in the room probably don't need this reminder, but that when there is an initial report from any PDP working group, it has to go out for public comment, and the mandatory minimum public comment period, except in exceptional circumstances, is 40 days. The working group then takes back all the public comments received, reviews it, and then prepares its final report based in part on its review of those responses. Thanks, Phil.
Rudy, for the transcript. So that means that if we want to get that finished for Dublin, there is a kind of urgency to start having this report, initial report, done and send it out for public comments rather quickly. Dublin is there in a few months, so 40 days plus the period that we need to consider for taking care of the comments, which probably is also 2 weeks, 3 weeks' time. We are close to Dublin.
Yeah, I don't anticipate this working group being completely finished by Dublin. I don't see how we do that. But I don't see any reason why, if we can engage with a legal expert over the summer, we couldn't have a preliminary report and recommendations out sometime, at least issued for public comment in September or even early October. And that way, it might still be open for comment at the time we discuss it in Dublin, but it will be, hopefully it will be, at least the initial report and recommendation will be out there. The comment period might still be open, but I think that's fine, you know, that's, and that would provide an extra opportunity if it's open for people to ask questions about it and provide input during the Dublin meeting. And that would still allow, I think, our full work, you know, a final report to be delivered prior to the end of the calendar year.
I agree. I don't think we're going to be done by Dublin, but absolutely by Marrakesh, I would imagine. I think it will also depend on what types of answers we get regarding the immunity question, because I have a feeling the immunity question is going to be quite complex. I don't think the answer is going to be as straightforward as maybe we would hope to write a very clear line in the report, just to add that as a thought. Also, to those who are listening in today from the community who haven't been part of our ongoing meetings, there's something I want to note because it was curious to me, but it may be typical. This committee sent out questionnaires to several members of the GAC, or all members of the GAC. I don't remember, Mary, who got our questionnaires. We sent questionnaires to the GAC and to IGOs asking questions to help guide us in terms of what systems were available for redress, about how IGOs are treated within certain jurisdictions, and just to try to give us some general guidance about how dispute resolutions may be handled in the wider world beyond the UDRP. And it was, we got very, very low response. And I actually found it quite surprising as a member of this working group, because this was an opportunity for members of the GAC as well as IGOs to really weigh in and have true substantive input into the process of the group. And I just have to say, as a member of the group, I did find it disappointing that we didn't get the kind of answers we were hoping for, or volume of answers we were hoping for.
Mary, why don't you respond, and then let's go to the gentleman at the end of the table.
Hi, this is John Pizarro from the OECD. I just want to say that we did provide pretty lengthy responses to the first set of questions that were the GNSO. With respect to the second set of questions, felt that they were phrased in such a way that, you know, the questions were in fact trying to get precisely the set of answers that you were looking for, and actually repeated a lot of the content that we thought we'd already clarified in the first set of questions. So just sort of in the interest of moving things along, rather than getting stuck in a debate that didn't really seem to be going anywhere, we decided to sort of rest with our first set of responses. But we remain, you know, available to answer questions informally, help try to clarify things, but it's difficult for us to just sort of rehash the same issues over and over again, and we had hoped and were a little bit disappointed that the answers to our first set of questions didn't really appear to have been taken on in the best faith possible.
Let me say,
what you're stating is that we will not get a formal response, but you're open for a more informal speech on this if we have specific issues that we want to follow up with you.
Exactly.
Let me just say, as co-chair, that I'm sorry there was any perception that in our second round of questions we were trying to ask them in a way that would predetermine the answers. We were sincerely seeking further clarification, and if there was that perception, that was not in any way our intent.
Well noted. Thank you for that.
Yeah, I was just going to follow up, and I don't recall reading the response, and my apologies to that. Was that issue raised in the second response, or you didn't respond at all? It's late in the week, and I apologize. The only reason I'm asking this is because I think that's a fair issue. And if that was the perception, it certainly would have been up to this group to clarify questions or rephrase questions in a way that didn't appear leading or whatever the specific issue was. I mean, we are absolutely 100%, to Phil's point, open to really what you have to say. This was not a fishing expedition in any for a specific answer at all. We really did feel that the guidance was warranted because I don't think we would have taken our time or wanted to waste your time, quite frankly.
So the first of all, I appreciate and share your fatigue. It is late in the week. We're all exhausted. The issues that I was talking about that were repeated were all of these immunity issues, and they had been brought up in that first set of questions. We gave pretty extensive responses, tried to break them down as clearly as possible because, you know, as our roles of as experts in international law, sort of talking to people who might not have the same day-to-day experiences that we have in discussing these issues. And we spent a lot of time working over these issues with a select group of IGOs to sort of give the most complete and clear responses that we could. And then it seemed to us that the same issues were coming up over and over again, the same questions about the extent, the role of our immunities and their importance to our functions as IGOs. And it just appeared to us that that wasn't at all sort of taken on board in the second set of questions, which appeared to repeat a lot of that same content. Thank you.
This is Mary, and again speaking for George Kirikos, who has a comment in the chat. His comment is that it should be pointed out that the PDP, this working group I think he means, was seeking data, that is to say facts and not just position statements.
Right. Well, we're still on the subject of sovereign immunity. Are there further questions on that? And I might ask, we have someone from the OECD. Do you have any views on the relevant scope of sovereign immunity that could assist us in this? The specific question is, let me give you, you can choose to answer or not answer, but if someone registered OEC.ninja, and whatever the content was, I'm not going to speculate, and you brought OECD brought a DRP against it, whether it's in the, UDRP, URS, or some new process, if the registrant chose to appeal, would you view to a national court, if it was a UDRP, would you view having to respond to that appeal in a court as violating the scope of the OECD's sovereign immunity? I don't want to put you on the spot, but you're here, and this is the basic question we're trying to figure out.
Yes, the IGOs have made clear over and over again that our immunities are integral to our ability to function independently. They're crucial to our mission. But I also want to point out that the OECD will never prevent someone from registering OECD.ninja, because we don't set policy in martial arts.
Let's say website, an OECD.
.edu, I think. EDU is a closed.
Let's say some website, OECD.something, was registered at some top-level domain, and there was content at the website having to do with economic development, where you felt that it was infringing. Forget the website. You bring a UDRP, because that's the only thing available. Nothing new has been created, and you don't want the expense of litigation. And you win, and the registrant thinks the decision's by the expert's been incorrect, and they appeal to a national court. I hear what you're saying. You're saying that any judicial process violates, but that's based on the scope of your activities. So, again, I don't want to put you on the spot, but I'm trying to understand how being involved in trademark-related litigation on whether a particular domain would in any way interfere with the actual functions of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. It wouldn't. The result of the dispute would in no way interfere with any of your actual activities in the world.
Can I answer that, please? I think we're really getting lost here. What we have in front of us is advice from the GAC to the board that protection of IGO names and acronyms is in the public interest. And this working group is also looking at that issue in parallel. In the April 29th reply from the GAC to this working group, and I'll just read it because I think it's really not particularly helpful to talk about would waiver of immunity in this particular situation or that particular situation be something that an IGO could take on board. What the GAC said to this working group was, in response to this precise question, was, the GAC notes that the IGOs, in their communication to you of 16th January 2015, have advised that they consider their claimed immunity from national jurisdiction to be fundamental to their role as international bodies. There are non-judicial means to ensure due process, such as arbitration, which the GAC believes should be considered in more detail. And frankly, I don't see why there's a need to go beyond that statement from the GAC and looking at the broader public policy interest that the GAC has expressed to the board that this working group is ostensibly also looking to address.
Well, with due respect, Brian, we do think, the members of this working group think there is a need to go beyond that simple statement because we have determined that the prevailing world view in the world today is that sovereign immunity does not provide absolute protection against all judicial procedures. And there is ample precedent for situations in which both nation states and IGOs have not been protected from court proceedings in particular instances. That's just the fact. Now, we're completely committed to, the members of this working group are completely committed to providing IGOs with reasonable means, rapid and low-cost means, for protecting their rights in the domain name system to protect their names and acronyms from abuse by domain registrants. But that doesn't mean that, as I stated before, they have rights, but domain registrants also have rights. And absolutely depriving domain registrants of a right to go to court when they think a valuable asset is being taken away from them is another consideration that this working group must take in view when before reaching final recommendations and conclusions. So, I mean, just saying we are IGOs and therefore we can never be subject to any court proceeding is not consistent with what goes on in the world today.
To even look at it another way, Lori, speaking, to look at it another way, too, it's, yes, registrants, presumably the defendants in these situations, have a right of appeal under the UDRP, but I think we have to look at the flip side, too, you know, the right of appeal of the IGO. You know, if the right of, if we decide or we recommend or we're instructed that this appeal right go, it's done, that the IGOs are not going to be subject to any sort of civil appeal in a court of jurisdiction, then what is the remedy? Does it stop at the UDRP? And I think that's a kind of an odd question, or maybe that is the question we're going to end up asking. I mean, there's no right of appeal in the URS, but the URS has different remedies. You know, we're talking at the UDRP level, the extreme remedy of transfer, which we don't have in the URS. So, you know, like the way you frame it, the right of the registrant, I get it, but I could even take that registrant right argument away and just say stop it at a level of, there may be a time, and I don't know this, that an IGO in this proceeding may actually be the defendant. I don't know, you know. I mean, we have to look at all possibilities. So I think we have to look at the question a little more broadly than that and just basically say, if the right of appeal goes away because of this immunity issue, what are we left with? And is that a situation then where we've got to figure out some creative way around that, or we just decide the UDRP is the end of the day, and it's the end of the day, and that's the type of amendment to the UDRP that we might suggest at some point? I don't know. So I don't want to really. I think you're completely right on the procedural end of things. It's probably at the end of the day, definitely more about a defendant registrant's right to appeal. But I'd like to see it discussed a little more broadly than that. That's all I guess I would say.
Well, frankly, the URS may be more convenient for IDOs than the UDRP as it is. I just wanted to also remind about, even if this was more of a country code discussion back in the 2003, but the SET's proposal, the number of countries expressed reservation about the process, like Australia, Canada, Japan, US, everything from the extra cost and burden of such a process, I'm talking about special appeal process, but what I wanted to cite is the comments from the U.S. delegations that was also supported by Japan, that they summarized. An arbitral appeal mechanism would contribute to eliminating the four most important due process safeguards of the UDRP: the possibility of broad court review, the limitation of the procedure to narrow causes to action, the limitation of available remedies, and the limitation of trademark rights for which there is a firm basis in international law. The delegation expressed concern that this might undermine the legitimacy of the UDRP as a whole. So, and I think it's interesting that it was actually coming from, let's say, GAC members at that time. And then we're talking about our own country code names.
And to add to that, Peter raised an important point, which is that individual nation states, the courts in international nation states often determine the scope of sovereign immunity through judicial decisions. When someone brings litigation against a nation or an IGO within their jurisdiction, and there's usually a motion to dismiss on the sovereign immunity issue, and they decide that. The U.S., United States passed a law regarding the scope of sovereign immunity for other nations operating within the U.S. I forget the name right now, I think. But the legislature has addressed it. And we did find a communication from the U.S. State Department in the early, I think it was in 2002, to the UN office, main U.S. office at the United Nations, where they were specifically asked, how does a foreign nation protects its national trademarks it's registered in the U.S.? And the advice was, bring a proceeding in the U.S. trademark office or bring a court proceeding. So the U.S. response was, if you're a nation state, if you're some entity that has sovereign immunity, and you think your trademark rights are being violated in the U.S., your remedy is to bring a court action in the U.S. So, nation states have varying views on the scope of sovereign immunity for other nations. So it's not, there's no simple view here. I don't know, even if we were to recommend creating a completely new process, which had no right of appeal, so only for IGOs with no right of appeal to a national court, that would not stop a losing registrant from going to court and seeking an injunction to prevent the transfer of their domain name if the court had jurisdiction over the registrar or the registry. So there's only so much we can do here. And ICANN can't extinguish legal rights or prevent the exercise of rights by legislatures and judiciary.
Yeah.
Yeah, Rudy for the transcript. Just to keep my memory cleared up, I always hear we are talking about IGOs. Would that also apply for INGOs? Or as I have seen, the INGOs has been scratched away from the debate, or is that incorrect?
No. Early on in our this working group, early on in its proceedings, determined that there was no need to address standing or sovereign immunity for INGOs because they are not in any way related to governments. They're private entities, and as private parties, they have the same standing as anyone else. If you have a trademark in your name or an acronym and you believe it's been violated, you have the option of either suing or using one of the dispute resolution processes created by ICANN to provide a more expeditious and lower cost means of protecting your rights.
And adding to that, we in fact also went through a great number of UDRP cases and US cases with INGOs, and we found that they have won each case except for, I think it was one for the Red Cross. And the reasons for that was a completely neutral legal. So we made that conclusion that there was no need to create anything new for those.
From OECD, go ahead.
I just think it's important to remind everyone, so we don't lose sight of this, that you know, whatever solution is ultimately recommended out of this process, it doesn't necessarily have to entail, we're not talking about denying someone right to appeal. We're talking about the mechanism through which someone might be able to appeal a decision of the UDRP, which could be achieved through arbitration, some other sort of administrative means of dispute resolution that doesn't have to involve a national court.
Yeah, we recognize that. On the other hand, a registrant, the existing DRPs, UDRP and URS, are not substitutes for a domain registrant's right to protect their domain or a complainant's right to go to court. They're supplements to it. And as I said, we could create a new CRP with an appeals mechanism that had no relationship to any judicial system, but that wouldn't prevent the domain registrant who loses in a decision and is going to lose their domain from, if they have standing under national law, if there's an applicable law, of going to court to seeking to stop that transfer. So there's a limit to what ICANN or any working group within ICANN can do on this subject. Lori and then Mary. I'm glad to see we're having a good heated exchange on this.
I support what you say, but with the caveat that I don't know, and again, playing devil's advocate, or maybe the angel's advocate, I'm not even sure at this point, do we care? I mean, as long as there's a mechanism for IGOs to exert their rights and there is some reasonable, and we agree that for due process purposes that a appeal mechanism, whether it's administrative or goes beyond administrative into civil courts, is the right way to go. I mean, we all have to acknowledge that there are different legal regimes in every single jurisdiction. I mean, the U.S. has a very strong regime, particularly with the Anti-Cyber Squatting Act and some other remedies that are available in the U.S. that aren't available anywhere else in the world, or at least to the same degree. So the first point you say is, yes, I agree. There's a point where we have to stop. But at the same time, I think there's also a point where we have to be fair and recognize sort of what the playing field does look like. And the ideal is to balance that. And I agree. I mean, anybody anywhere in the world can avail themselves of a administrative system, and depending on what the rules of that system are, they're always going to have a right in their, or mostly, presumably, have a right within their own national systems to assert a claim. Whether or not the other party will actually be able to be legally bought into that claim is another story. And again, maybe we don't care. I mean, maybe that's the level where we stop, that we've done the best we can within the administrative construct we have, and then we're done.
Okay. Let me respond a bit. I wanted to first comment. Earlier you said there's no right of appeal under the URS. I'm not sure that's correct. I believe within the URS, there's no right to appeal to a court. Yeah, there is a right.
Sorry, my apologies. There's two rights of appeal.
Yeah, but there is a right to ask the URS provider to reconsider their decision, essentially to review their own decision.
But that's not independent review. I'm sorry. Are there rights? You can educate me on this because I'm mixing up the rules in my head, but is there a right of independent review?
That's no. Well, the other thing is
all right.
A losing complainant in a URS has a right to file a UDRP, which
that's
has
not
a,
an appeal, though. That's a different
well,
means
but
of, it's not an appeal.
I'm defining appeal broadly. You lose the initial decision, you want it reconsidered. I know in the URS there's a right to ask the dispute provider to reconsider their decision. There is an internal appeal. It's not to an independent. It's to the same body that made the initial decision.
Right, I want to clarify my frame of reference. When I say appeal, in my mind, my legalistic mind, I'm thinking a right of an appeal to an independent body that looks not to the decision maker, not to the UDRP.
Well,
just to me, those are different. If you're asking somebody to reconsider a request, but it's not an independent review. And I'm just, again, to clarify where my points are coming from, that there's an independent adjudicator involved, that it isn't going to another mechanism within the UDRP, which would be going to the UDRP, which would be the second mechanism under the URS, or asking the URS provider to relook at their own decisions. Those are relooks, but I'm thinking extremely legalistically.
Well, I think within URS, I think they label it appeal. I'm going to just speak on this, Mary, and then let you provide us with the facts, which is probably what. But I know that whether you call it an appeal, what I'm calling an appeal more broadly is either the complainant or the registrant is unhappy with the initial determination of the expert and wants it reconsidered, reopened. And under the URS, I know they can ask the dispute provider to reconsider it. I also know that the complainant, if they lose the URS, can file a UDRP, which has a lower burden of proof, because they might feel, well, I couldn't prove it was a black and white case, but I might be able to prove on preponderance of the evidence. I believe the registrant also has a right to take it up to UDRP if they lose the URS. But let's let Mary jump in, or Petter here.
You can correct me then, but I'll just quickly say this. Normally, three steps. And the first one, there's a very quick decision that you normally don't have any replies from the main holder. And then there is a specific timeline when the main holder, often that had lost the first, sometimes a very, very few cases, the initial decision is that it should not be stopped. And then there is some kind of appeal, but there's still a single panelist. And then the third step with three panelists, and that's also the only step where you actually have a more wordable decision, where you can actually read about what conclusions the panelists have done. And then again, I've also seen the same cases where up to the third step, the complainant had lost it and then turned into a UDRP case instead, often asking for three panels to decide upon it. So, but it's the URS, in this case, I think it works somewhat in a good way, but they're also difficulties with it.
Mary, enlighten us.
Actually, I had my hand up earlier for a comment from George, but let me address this particular point, and then if I may go to the comment from George. So maybe using the word appeal, different people are using it differently. So just to confirm some things that folks have said, that the URS does not preclude going to court and filing the relevant proceeding. The URS does not preclude a proceeding under the UDRP. And if there is a URS decision, what some folks, I think, are talking about an appeal in the URS is phrased as a de novo review, meaning a reexamination of the case. And Christine Dorain from National Arbitration Forum, who's in the Adobe Connect room and who is one of the providers for the URS, confirms that even if it's the same provider, it would go to a different panelist.
Yes, there is that. I believe the URS provides the registrant with up to a year to request a de novo review by a different expert. And just, Laura, you said, what does it matter? Well, we have the working group we have, and there's quite a number of registrants and registrant attorneys, and they believe, based on experience, that preserving the registrant's right to access a national court of a relevant jurisdiction is extremely important to them. It's the working group we have, and we've invited participation by GAC and IGO members, and there's been just about zero participation by them as participants in the working group.
I want to clarify, what does it matter? I don't mean that your registrant's rights don't matter. That was not the intention.
I know.
The
I
point
know.
Is that there is a degree of review, whatever you want to call it, that stops at a certain level. We recommend that it stops at whatever that level is, but there is always going to be a remedy in your home jurisdiction to some degree. That's my point. And we
right.
can't know every jurisdiction. We can't know every remedy. So the what does it matter isn't about that the remedy doesn't matter, but there is a point. And I think we completely agree here, Phil, maybe, I thought, that there is a limit to what we can recommend.
And that's exactly the point I made before. We could create an entirely new curative rights process with an appeals mechanism that does not include, that does not involve judiciaries, and that could not stop a losing complainant or a losing registrant from going to court if they're unhappy with the decision and the appeal result and seeking further redress.
Plus one.
Yeah. And I want to, again, put this in context, just to remind everyone that the majority of UDRP and URS cases are default cases that get no response from the registrant. So it'd be extremely rare, unusual to have a default registrant filing an appeal. And even in those cases where the registrant has responded and the about two-thirds, I know in the UDRP, about two-thirds of the cases get no response. Of the remaining one-third that get a response, the results come out about 50-50 for complainant and registrant. So in that 50-50 situation, if the registrant lost, in the majority of cases, they never file an appeal in a national court. So we're talking about a consideration, just to put the discussion in context, an appeal by a registrant would be a very rare circumstance, and there's not a lot of, there may be more cases brought by IGOs once we finish this, if whatever we come up with is accepted, but there still probably wouldn't be a whole lot of cases brought by IGOs in the context of total UDRP and URS cases.
There's some discussion in the Adobe Connect chat about the narrow scope of the URS, but specific to this point, a point of clarification that's confirmed by Christine Dorain of NAF in the chat as well, that when we talk about the ability to file for up to a year, that it refers to the cases of default. And in those cases, it goes back to the same person or panelist. In terms of the de novo review that we spoke about earlier, which, like I said, most folks consider an appeal, that does not go to the same panelist, but that is limited to up to 15 days following the initial decision.
Let me, unless we've spent, and I think it's great, we spent a lot of time discussing sovereign immunity. We've got real engagement here. We have 15 minutes left in this session. I haven't even asked my question yet, Marianne. Your hands are up. And what was I going to say? Let's see your powers of precognition.
Please proceed.
Such a test, Phil. And it's all right if I fail it, but I did want to say that maybe the burning comment or some equivalent that you might perhaps be asking people to raise in the last few minutes, that there was a comment from George earlier on that at some point prior to ending, if I may be permitted to read it out. Sure.
Why don't you read it out, and then I'll tell you what I was going to say.
And I suppose I might end up owing you a drink or two. Thank you, everybody. Thank you.
You can just take that as a default position, no matter what goes on in this room.
That is true. So first, thanks, George, for your patience while we were deliberating the URS issue. George made an earlier comment about the question of eliminating a right to appeal by a registrant, and he says that one can do a thought experiment on that point. So what would happen if a mark holder, which could be an IGO or otherwise, wanted to enforce its rights if the UDRP did not exist? Answer, they would need to go to court. The existence of the UDRP is an optional tool that doesn't override existing rights. ICANN isn't in the business of creating new rights. The UDRP as it stands now does not create a new right because it can be overridden by the real courts. So eliminating the right to go to court would be a huge change which would deprive registrants of real rights. Indeed, it would cause divergence between the UDRP's jurisprudence and the courts because UDRP panelists would no longer have the check and balance of real courts and national laws relating to trademarks.
Thanks for reading that in. I just want to state again, this working group has not yet consulted with a recognized legal expert, as we're planning to do, and we'll take their input into very serious consideration regarding the generally accepted view on the scope of sovereign immunity for both nation states and IGOs. I'm gonna actually say what I intended to say about 5 minutes ago before I let you speak again, Mary, which is that in the remaining now 8 minutes of this session, I had hoped to bring up, if we've exhausted the sovereign immunity issue, which we're clearly not going to solve in this session. The other thing the GAC asked in their, or stated in their Los Angeles communique, was that whatever we did, they wanted us to create a rights protection regime for IGOs, which was either free or of nominal cost. Now, we did ask the GAC, and the GAC replied, but not with a specific answer that was really very illuminating, whether they considered the existing cost of the URS, which is, we're not talking about legal costs, we're talking about the filing fee. URS costs $500. UDRP costs $1,500, about $1,500 for a single examiner. It costs more, of course, if one of the parties wants to request a three-expert panel, but each of these procedures is far less expensive than filing in court. I know generally if you want to bring a litigation in federal court in the United States, the law firm you contact will generally ask for an initial retainer of between $25,000 and $50,000 just to start federal litigation in the United States. It's a very expensive process. So this working group is also looking at the question of whether we've told the GAC that we have no ability to create a free process, that experts have to be paid, someone has to pay them, and if they're not going to be paid by the IGO, the funding has to come somewhere else, and we don't have any capacity in this working group to create a fund or a subsidy mechanism for IGO filings. But that issue is out there. We are considering it, but any views by anyone in the room or online of whether the existing filing fees for URS and UDP fit the definition of nominal would be welcome, either now or at any time as we continue our work And Mary, did you still have something you wanted to say after?
I had after something that George wanted to say.
Is it short?
Yes, actually.
Why don't you read it out, and then we'll...
But first, I want to apologize to George for not completing his original comment, because he did have a separate one. And to complete the original one, he says, eliminating the right to appeal would encourage forum shopping by complainants, because providers would have incentives to provide a quote-unquote better result. His separate comment on a related point about the mandatory arbitration is that he says there are laws against mandatory consumer arbitration, and so a new DRP along those lines would violate those laws.
Thank you. Well, I'll open it now. Up now for yes, sir. And you came in since we started. Could you identify yourself?
Klaus Stoll, NPOC, for the record, for the transcript. Just to pick up on your point of the value and the money, what is it? Maybe you should not look at it in a strictly monetary point of saying $1, $500, $1,500, but actually what the product you're trying to defend is actually worth. You understand what I'm trying to say? Not what is reasonable or marginal depends on for a trademark, which is basically, or a name, which is basically your whole organization IGO depends on. Yeah, it has a huge value, so it's the marginal becomes much larger and something which is not of so much of importance to you. So it should be not only seen on a monetary scale, but also on a value scale.
Right. Well, I take that. I take your point that that's more of a philosophical point than a cost benefit point. But the point I was trying to make is that no matter whether we're talking about the URS, the UDRP, or some brand new process, the determination has to be made by a legal expert or experts. And they tend not to work for free. Perhaps we can identify a pool of legal experts who would be willing to work pro bono for IGOs generally, or for IGOs with limited monetary resources. Perhaps WIPO among their pool, WIPO is a very well-known IGO. Perhaps they can ask their experts whether any of them are willing to do that. I was just trying to, and we heard from the GAC this the other morning, the suggestion that maybe the pool of money from the last resort auctions, some of it could be set aside to fund this. But I think in the session, the high interest session we had Monday afternoon, we heard many suggestions for how people want to spend that money, probably enough to spend it several times over in a single year. So, but this working group, we're looking for guidance on whether folks believe the existing fees for filing a URS or UDRP satisfy the GAC request for a nominally priced process, but we have no ability to create a mechanism that lets IGOs file for free.
Actually, we have received a response from GAC that, again, you have to read between the lines, but, I mean, the initial request was to look at, as you said, reducing or no cost at all. And then we got, when we sent out our new questionnaire to GAC, frankly saying that do you consider the current fees charged by URS and UDRP provides to be nominal, etc. And GAC's very clear response was that the GAC is not in a position to assess the current fees charged by URS and UDRP providers as being nominal or not. Again, the GAC is happy to participate in further discussions that should ideally include the IGOs. So at least there was not no indication that they still consider it too high. And I got more the impression that the cost question was something that they had to throw out to be considered, and that they may be accept our conclusion that the costs are already rather low. As you said, thinking of that there is actually experts that's dealing carefully with these cases.
Yes, Brian.
Thank you. Brian Beckham for the record. I just wanted to make a small point on the comment about the cost to the IGO of filing under whatever dispute resolution mechanism would be available. It's not so much in terms of looking at what's the quote-unquote benefit or utility to the IGO in a domain name. Quite the contrary. What is being addressed would be misuse of their identity to prevent consumer harm. So I think it's just important to come back to that principle when the working group is looking at what is being addressed here as preventing harm to consumers in the internet.
Yeah, thanks for that comment. I would echo that. What we're protecting when we protect a trademark, or in this case, the name or acronym, we're protecting it from misuse by third parties who are either putting out statements, misleading the public, putting out statements that are contrary to the views of the organization, but that might mislead some people and wind up at that website and believing those are views or activities of the IGO that they're being confused about. In the more extreme cases, with it might be soliciting funds where people are believe they're supporting something when in fact there's a scam going on. So it's not just protecting the value, but it's protecting the public from being misled and abused. We're at our scheduled endpoint. Are there any final comments that people feel compelled to make? And I remind everyone that we are at least several months away from completing a preliminary report and recommendations, that we are completely open to further input from all interested parties and participation by all interested parties, that we're nowhere near even that preliminary report. And once we complete that preliminary report, which we hope to do so before the Dublin meeting, there's going to be a 40-day period of public comment before there's a final report and recommendations. And then whatever's done with that final report and recommendations will be up to ultimately the ICANN board. So we're a long way from the finish line here and still have a very open process. And yes, Laurie.
Yeah, I just want to thank you and Petter and Mary for shepherding us over the last year. I think these are highly complex issues. There's been a lot of talk. Even today was a great example of some of the back and forth that we share. And whether you play the devil or the angel in this, I think it's important to hash these issues out. And again, I just wanted to appreciate the leadership, the thought leadership, as well as the administrative leadership to get us to where we are today. Thank you.
Thank you for the record.